Okay. Okay, we can start. Did anyone have any questions before we begin? Everything's okay in terms of the logistics, getting the course back, all that sort of thing. I just wanted to remind everybody, no more PTE numbers are going to be given out today. So if you're in the class today with the hope of getting a PTE number, you don't have to stay if you don't want to. Today I'm going to be talking about the origins of the First World War, an extremely important historical topic. I think probably more attention has been given to this particular historical issue than to any other historical issue of comparable scope. First World War broke out 100 years ago, and people are still talking about it, still arguing about it. And you'll probably be hearing a lot of these arguments this year because of the 100th anniversary. Why is this subject of such interest from our point of view? Because it plays a very central role in international relations theory. There's scarcely any international relations theory that you could point to that doesn't include some reference to the origins of the First World War, that doesn't make some sort of argument about what caused the First World War and use that argument to support more general claims about how international politics works. Okay? And the issue is also important because after the First World War, in the 1920s especially, but also in the 1930s, people argued a lot about what had caused the war. And different interpretations of the origins of the war had enormous political importance, right? The peace treaty that was imposed on Germany after her defeat in 1918, the Treaty of Versailles of 1919, this was rooted quite explicitly in the claim that Germany was primarily responsible for the war. A lot of German policy was rooted in the desire to throw off that burden of guilt and all of the discriminations that went along with it. And so that the conflict between Germany and the Western powers, the victorious powers, that began almost immediately after Germany's defeat in 1918, turned in large measure on these questions of what had caused the war. And in fact, it became clear that you weren't going to have a stable peace as long as people were talking about who should be blamed, who were the aggressors, who had decided to kind of plunge Europe into this enormous catastrophe, right? And so gradually a different view emerged, which was that, the war wasn't a war of German aggression. It wasn't a war of aggression on the part of Germany's opponents either. The war wasn't consciously brought about. It wasn't deliberately brought about by anybody. It happened because of the workings of the system that was in place at the time. The political system, the system of alliances, the old diplomacy, the way diplomacy was practiced, that it didn't take account of moral principles, like the principle of self-determination. It was based on this kind of old-fashioned idea that politics was the province of the political elite, that they should pursue their policy based on what was in the interest of the country, interest defined in terms of power, that the whole goal was to improve a country's power political position vis-a-vis its neighbors. And it was that struggle for power political advantage that pushed these states into conflict with each other. It was the system that was to blame. And the military system went along with that. Military system. It was all the interacting mobilizations, the emphasis on offensive military action, all that kind of thing. This led to a war that never should have happened. It was the system that was responsible, not human beings. Right? And so people wanted to believe these things because it let everyone off the hook. And it provided the basis for some sort of reconciliation between Germany and the Western powers. So these issues of historical interpretation were politically important, especially in the post-World War I period. And they're also of enormous theoretical significance, especially since the basic historical arguments have a certain direct political, direct theoretical resonance. What's the basic historical issue here? Well, is this a war of aggression or not? Especially a war of German aggression. Did the Germans deliberately cause it or not? Or did some other power, some other power to blame? Who's to blame? You know, this is the normal, natural way of approaching the question of the origins of a war. Who's to blame? It's the way people do it if they haven't studied these things. And the power of international relations theory is rooted in the insight that that is not the way to get at these issues. Right? There's something more going on here than aggressors deciding to start a war. Right? The whole theoretical framework that developed, and a lot of this is associated with the term realism, about which we'll be talking a lot in the course of the quarter. The theoretical framework is that there are mechanisms in place that go beyond, you know, simple aggression. Countries are pretty much forced to behave like aggressors if they're in a certain strategic environment, whether they would want to or not. They have to reach for increased power just to provide for their own safety, their own security. And that struggle for security is what, you know, puts states at odds with each other, right? So this whole notion, was it a war of aggression or was the system responsible? That has this kind of theoretical significance that relates to these claims of what makes for war, you know? Should it be approached in terms of individual actions, or should it be approached in terms of the logic of the system that's in place at the time? Should we emphasize human decision, or should we emphasize structural forces? All right? So the issue is, it's very important in those terms. Right. Question. Are those the only two ways in which the whole problem of the origins of the First World War is to be, you know, can be approached, is to be understood? Was it, you know, a lot of people think, well, either it was a war of aggression or it wasn't. Either people started, wanted it, or they didn't want it. You know, if they didn't want it, it must be the system that's responsible. All these impersonal forces. You know? Are those the only two ways? And one of the basic points that I want to make today, and hopefully convince you of today, is that there's a third way to kind of get at these issues. And this is the historical approach. This is the approach that views war as the climax of a process unfolding over time. Not just years, but even decades. A process that has a certain logic to it. A process in which countries pursue policies about which moral judgments are somewhat problematic. Hard to say, you know, who's the aggressor and who's the victim. The moral issues are kind of very fuzzy, very blurry. Right? War results from that process unfolding over time. You could put yourself in the shoes of the different actors involved, different countries, leaders of different countries, on each side, and you could have a certain sympathy for what each side is up against and why each side is making the decisions it does. Doesn't mean that everything is all determined in advance. There's always a range of choice and free will and so on. But you can sympathize, see things through the eyes of the different actors involved. When you do that, you can construct a story that makes sense, has elements of a tragedy, if you can sympathize with people on both sides. They're doing what they think is best. They're not evil people. And yet, the policies that they pursue, the interaction between these states, leads to a conflict that in retrospect, all of them would have wanted to avoid. Okay? In this sense, getting at the question of what caused the war, getting at the question of historical explanation, is tantamount to grasping what that logic is, the logic that leads from point A to point B to point C to point D and ultimately to the war. Right? I mean, I have to say that for me, when I first took a course in European diplomatic history when I was a freshman at Berkeley in 1962, I was just bowled over by the power of that perspective. Because I had come in thinking, well, how do you understand a war? You figure out who's to blame. And then I took this course, and it was about the European diplomatic history in the 19th century, the period up to 1914. And the instructor, Raymond Sontag, who's the author of one of the things you're going to be reading this quarter, he basically told it as a story. You know, he kind of showed how things looked through the eyes of the different actors involved, right? And that there was this you can make sense of that story. It had a logic to it. Totally different way of approaching the problem of war causation. I'll be coming back to this. So what do I want to do today? I want to kind of, in very broad brush terms, give you some sort of sense for what that story is, how the problem of the origins of the First World War is to be understood, especially from that last point of view. And to do that, we're going to start in 1871. I'm going to just get the map now. There we go. Good. 1871, extremely important date in the history of European politics in the 19th century. Okay, because the structure of European politics was utterly transformed with the victory of Prussia in the Franco-Prussian War. Right, the victory of Prussia leading to the unification of Germany and to the emergence of a powerful German state in the heart of Europe. It didn't exist before 1871. Before 1871, there were German states. There were a lot of them. The two most important ones were Prussia in the north and Austria in the south. But the maker of Prussian policy in the 1860s, Otto von Bismarck, the titanic figure who dominates this whole period, in a series of three wars, he managed to transform Prussia from the weakest of the European great powers into this powerful German state, which was the strongest of the five European great powers. So instead of a relative power vacuum in the center of Europe, where Prussian and Austrian ambitions in Germany, which would be the number one power within Germany, largely cancel each other out, you know, and it meant that the wing powers, Russia in the east and France and Britain in the west, would be the dominant powers there. Now Austria had reconciled herself to the predominance of Prussia in Germany, and this new German empire, this new German unified German state, was essentially Prussia writ large, right? The most powerful of the European powers. You no longer have a power vacuum of sorts in Central Europe. Now Prussia, now Germany, is number one. But number one doesn't mean that this new German empire is a hegemon. That's to say, the dominant power, by far the strongest power, can deal with any situation that develops, doesn't have to worry about all the other great powers in Europe ganging up against her. You know, she could assert her will, and there would be no countervailing force to stop her. Prussia, now Germany, is not in that position at all. Not strong enough to impose a will. The Germans still have to worry about the configuration of power in Europe, whether, you know, they have to worry about the other powers in Europe, you know, forming a coalition to kind of balance Germany and limit what she could do, and not necessarily invade her and destroy her, but in all these political disputes that develop, those disputes are the outcome of those disputes is determined by what would happen in a war. Who's the strongest country or bloc of countries? And so all these statesmen have to worry about power considerations. They have, you know, it's not like they're necessarily afraid of being invaded, but in all these issues that come up of, you know, what the fate of the Balkans is going to be, or Turkey, or whatever, they want to have a certain say. Because if they don't have a say, then things can develop in a way that long way down the road it's going to affect their power position and maybe in a very negative way. They want to hit that off. So they have to be concerned with power. Very normal, very natural. What does it mean for Bismarck in 1871, this situation? He said, in a Europe of five great powers, the key thing is to be one of three. Right? If you're not a part of a bloc of three, you're at the mercy of the rival bloc. They would beat you in a showdown. Plus, you would be totally dependent on the one remaining power that continues to be associated with you. That also limits your power position. You don't want that. You want to kind of dilute that sort of dependence. Therefore, you want to be at least one of three, maybe even one of four, if that's possible. But what sort of coalition is possible for Bismarck? Not one that includes France. France is hostile to Germany throughout this period. Why? Because Germany had annexed these two provinces, Alsace and Lorraine, that thought of themselves were French, that all the French thought of as French. French never reconciled themselves to the loss of those two provinces. Okay. It couldn't include France. So what sort of coalition was possible? Well, there were two coalitions that were conceivable. One, the coalition of the three Eastern empires, Germany, Russia, Austria. Right? This had a certain logic, too. These were three conservative states. They had a common interest in suppressing revolutionary activity, and especially in areas like Poland that they had divided among themselves in the late 18th century. But there was a problem with that coalition, namely that Austrian and Russian ambitions clashed in southeastern Europe. And this whole area here we call the Balkans. Balkan Peninsula here. Russia was not a status quo power. Russia was, throughout the 18th century, you look at the maps, Russia had been expanding by leaps and bounds. And Russia's still had her eyes on expansion to the south, and especially in getting control of the Turkish Straits. And the road to the Turkish Straits led through at least the eastern Balkans. Plus, within Russia, there were all these people called Pan-Slavs who thought that it was Russia's historic mission to liberate the Slavs from what was still then, in the 1870s, Turkish rule or Turkish misrule, people would have said at the time. But if Russia dominated even the eastern Balkans, you know, Romania, Bulgaria, and that whole area down there, then Austria's position in the Western Balkans might be undermined. No guarantee that Russia would simply be content to keep what she had, but rather the liberation or the penetration of Russian influence into the Eastern Balkans would create a base for Russia to penetrate even the Western Balkans and to support the aspirations of the Slavic nationalities in the Western Balkans, like the Serbs and the Croats and so on, and what was to become ultimately Yugoslavia. at Austria's expense, you know, to destroy the integrity of the Austrian state. So to kind of prevent that from happening, the Austrians felt that they had to head it off. And they didn't want Russia to kind of control even the Eastern Balkans. Well, this created a natural tension between Austria and Russia, and it meant that the viability of that particular alignment, the three Eastern empires, Germany, Russia, Austria, you know, was problematic. Right? That tension between Austria and Russia would prove it could easily prove its undoing. So Bismarck felt he needed a second iron in his fire. And what was that? Alignment with Britain. Britain, Germany, Austria. Because Britain and Austria, they had a common interest, namely the containment of Russian expansionism, keeping Russia away from the Turkish Straits. Keeping Russia away from the Mediterranean. This common interest meant that Britain and Austria, with Germany in the background, could kind of cooperate in keeping Russian power at bay. In principle, it was a viable alignment. There was only one problem here. The problem was that Britain was a democracy by this point. And that meant that every 7 years or so, you had a change of government. And when the conservatives, you know, people like Lord Salisbury, great diplomatist of late 19th century England, were in power, this sort of relationship with Germany and Austria could work very smoothly. On the other hand, when the liberals, people like William Gladstone, were in power, you couldn't say that. Gladstone believed in moral principles, namely the right of self-determination. He was sympathetic with the aspirations of these Balkan nationalities to throw off the Turkish yoke. It was intolerable that the Turks should be allowed to do what they were doing, and just, you know, whenever there was an uprising in the Balkans, they would send in these irregular troops, and there would be massacres and so on. When Gladstone was in power, the alignment with Austria to contain Russia and prevent a change in the status quo in the Balkans, that couldn't work. And it would force Germany to come out much more overtly on the side of Austria than she would have preferred. And that would alienate Russia and drive Russia over to the side of France, and Germany's power position would be weakened. So there's a problem with the alignment with Britain as well. Right? So what's the best Bismarck can do? He has to balance between these two possible alignments, the alignment of the three Eastern empires and the alignment with Britain. It serves a certain purpose to have two irons in the fire. Because if Russia pushes you too hard, you say, well, then I'm going to lean much more strongly to this alignment with Britain. And if the British don't go along with you, you threaten the British that you're going to lean more strongly toward favoring Russian interests. And those two threats would tend to keep relations with both Britain and Russia fairly decent from Germany's point of view. That's the, you know, it's a complex strategy, not an easy strategy to understand. And they had no guarantees that it's going to work even. Because if Russia says, We're not getting a fair shake from our relationship with Germany. In the final analysis, Germany is going to side with Austria. In fact, Germany is in alliance with Austria, 1879. Let's just wash our hands of this whole business and go over to the side of France. Right? And there were real problems with this Eastern alignment at the very end of the Bismarckian period. Bismarck did what he could to preserve it, but there are clear signs that maybe this is not going to last forever. As it was, a new emperor takes office in Germany, William II. He and Bismarck do not get along at all. Bismarck is basically forced out of office in 1890, and William II decides to pursue a different, more straightforward policy than Bismarck had. He refuses to maintain the alignment with Russia that Bismarck had worked out, and instead kind of opts for developing friendship with Britain. Right? The Russians get frightened by this. They feel like they have relatively little to lose. They make an alliance, first an entente, then an alliance with France, 1893, 1894. The Germans kind of get second thoughts. They thought they, you know, it seemed like they had made a big mistake alienating Russia like that. They then try to make amends for it by being very nice to the Russians. The Russians say, well, this is proof that what we did was right, that the alliance with France made sense. You know, it's bringing Germany to our senses. Let's maintain our alliance with France. It gives us more independence. Notice that the Franco-Russian alliance is not an alliance that had as its origins fear of German power. It's not like these two countries are coming together to kind of contain rising German power. In fact, when Germany was strong during the Bismarckian period, Russia was very eager for good relations with Germany. Right? And now it's like a sense of, oh, maybe Germany isn't quite that strong. Russia has a much freer hand to kind of develop an independent policy. Okay. So what you have in the by the early 1890s is continental Europe being divided between these two blocks of approximately equal power. Germany and Austria. You know, Germany being the strongest of the continental powers, Austria being the weakest, number one and number four, so to speak, versus France and Russia, number two and number three. Right? Bottom line, approximately equal power. And so the structure of European politics is going to be determined by what happens with Britain? Which way will Britain go? This is the great drama of the 1890s. Will Britain side with Austria and Germany in a policy based on the containment of Russia? Or will she side with France and Russia, trying to kind of work out deals with those countries? Because British interests clash with those of France and Russia throughout this period in very major ways. With Russia throughout the entire rim of Asia, from the Turkish Straits in the west, you know, through Iran and the approaches to India, you know, Afghanistan, Tibet, and then even all the way into northern China. That is a vast area. And British interests clash with France, especially in Africa, most notably in the case of Egypt, but other parts of Africa as well. Right? Britain has an interest in ending those conflicts. Whenever you have bad relations with another country, that's a source of weakness. It makes you vulnerable to pressure from third countries. Which way will Britain go? Side with one of the continental blocks, or keep her hands free, trusting in the notion that neither of those two blocks is strong enough to defeat Britain on its own. And not only that, but if Britain ever got into real trouble in the hands of one of those two blocks, the other would probably come to British support. Right? You don't have to make any commitment. This was Lord Salisbury's view. But British power is on the wane. British power is declining. Why? Because Britain had achieved an exceptional power political position by virtue of the fact that she had been the first country to industrialize. Right? Britain throughout the 19th century was the world's premier industrial power. Right? She didn't have to maintain an army. Because she was an island, the resources that would otherwise have gone into an army were plowed into a navy. So Britain was the world's premier naval power. Navies being more capital intensive than armies, you know, made sense also for a very wealthy country to build a powerful navy. Thanks to a powerful navy, Britain was the world's premier imperial power. She had scooped up all the best parts of the overseas world and forged them into this huge British empire. Right? But in the course of, especially the late 19th century, the continental countries were also industrializing, above all Germany, which was industrializing very rapidly and on the verge of overtaking Britain in terms of industrial power. The sense of Britain in decline meant we can't afford isolation anymore. We need to find some way, some reducing the burden that we have to carry, you know, by ending these quarrels with, especially with France and Russia. We have to reach some sort of accommodation, because if we don't, then we're going to be vulnerable to all sorts of pressure, not just from those countries, but from all the other powers, because they know we'll have our hands full. Which way will Britain go? The decision is made around 1900. Salisbury has to give up the foreign secretaryship. It's replaced by Lord Lansdowne. A whole group of people come in. They say, we're not strong enough anymore to go our own way in a totally independent way. We have to form some sort of alignment with one of the continental blocs. Which will it be? And it could have easily gone the other way, toward Germany. But the Germans sense that the British need them more than they need Britain. They could place their demands relatively high. And they have all these ambitions at this point for becoming a world power, just like Britain, maybe ultimately to displace Britain as the world's premier imperial power, develop a large overseas empire, you know, which in the long run is the only real basis for Germany to be a truly independent state, to acquire the territory they would need to kind of sustain their position in world affairs. Right? British sense this is one of the major factors that leads them to move to the side, first to France with the Anglo-French Entente of 1904, and then through France to Russia with the Anglo-Russian Entente of 1907, leading to what was called the Triple Entente. You can see here the three green states, that's the Triple Entente, versus the Triple Alliance, Germany, Austria, and Italy, although Italy, you know, had basically moved away from the alignment with Austria and Germany, remained, you know, in effect on paper, but in reality, Italy moved to the other side. Okay, so Britain makes her decision. She makes a decision, and the Germans get upset. They sense that Britain is the center of this anti-German conspiracy aimed at keeping Germany down. They want to break the Anglo-French Entente, not with the goal of destroying France, but by weaning France away from Britain and forging some sort of continental bloc with France and Russia, they could pursue their goals of pursuing a policy aimed at developing their position as a world power, a policy that Britain was the primary obstacle to. Right? So the British sense this. They sense what's at stake. They understand that the Germans have this strategy. The strategy is put into effect in 1905. It leads to a crisis called the First Moroccan Crisis of 1905. British respond by tightening their commitment to France. And what this leads to, this First Moroccan Crisis, and even more importantly, the Second Moroccan Crisis of 1911, has the same sort of effect. It leads to the opening of a huge gap between Germany and the Western powers. Right? The Germans feel they're just not going to get a fair shake in terms of their imperial aspirations from Britain and France. Their only hope is to improve their power position by improving their relations with Russia. They court Russia. Okay? But Britain and France, they see what's going on. They understand how important Russia is. And they respond by moving toward support not just of kind of core Russian interests, the defense of the Russian state, but also of Russian aspirations in the Balkans. This is very important. It's like Russia is in the driver's seat in these years before the war, 1912, 1913. Russia is in the driver's seat. Why? Because Russia is so much stronger than these other countries. No, Russian military weakness had been revealed in the Russo-Japanese War, 1905. Right? You know, that it led to a revolution inside Russia in 1905. The kind of weakness of the whole czarist regime had been revealed. The czar had been forced to kind of grant all these reforms and so on. It's not Russian strength that gave Russia this position, but rather the fact that this gap had opened up between Germany and the Western powers. You know, each of them felt like Russia was going to be the decisive factor. Russia had to be courted. Russia's price for maintaining good relations with one or the other, you know, correspondingly rose. It's an artifact of the deterioration of the relationship between Germany on the one hand, Britain and France on the other. You see this sort of dynamic at work in international politics all the time. I mean, when the Soviet Union and China developed a very intense dispute in the course of the 1950s, you know, climaxing in the early 1960s, and going through the late 1960s and so on, the Americans were bound to profit from that. It was like it was effortless on the part of the U.S. government, because Russia and China, each is more afraid of each other than either of them is of a distant power like the United States. They have an interest in pulling the United States over to their side. And this is despite the fact that Russia and China are both communist states, and America has a very different kind of government. This is this sort of dynamic is very common. But how did it affect Russian policy in these years before the war? It enabled the Russians to pursue a forward policy in the Balkans, a very aggressive policy in the Balkans. Okay. Russia was the champion of what was called the Balkan League. It was based on Bulgaria and Serbia kind of coming together, forming the nucleus of a coalition that was designed to kind of conduct a war against Turkey and force the Turks out of Europe. The result of that policy would be great expansion in the territory and thus in the power of those Balkan states. And for Austria, an expansion of Serbian power was a big danger, because the Serbs made no bones about the fact that they wanted to be the nucleus of a great southern Slav state, a state carved not just out of Turkish territory, but out of Austrian territory as well. And, you know, Serbia allowed itself to serve as the base for terrorist groups that operated within Austrian territory. Austrians were becoming very frustrated with this. But the key thing from our point of view is that all of this was possible only because Britain and France agreed to go along with it, agreed to underwrite this aggressive Russian policy in the Balkans. It's quite extraordinary. When the French Prime Minister, his name was Poincaré, was shown the text of the Balkan League Treaty on a visit to St. Petersburg, then the Russian capital, in August of 1912, he told the Russians in amazement, this carries within itself the seeds of a war, not just against Turkey, but against Austria as well. The Russians were playing with fire. They could do it because they felt that Britain and France were going to have to support them. Because if they didn't, and Russia defected over to the side of Germany, Britain and France would be too weak to deal with the German power on their own. Russia was in the driver's seat. Russia could pursue this sort of policy. Okay? So you had, in the decade before the First World War, a whole series of crises. The first Moroccan crisis of 1905-1906. Then there was something, the Bosnian crisis, 1908-1909. Second Moroccan crisis, 1911. The crises of the Balkan Wars. You know, how much extra territory were the Balkan states going to be allowed to acquire at the expense of Turkey? The crises of the Balkan Wars, 1912-1913. Right? What happens when you have a whole series of crises like that? Well, a number of things. One thing is, crisis runs its course. The country that wins the crisis because its opponent backs down says, the tough line we took was vindicated. In the future, we should be equally tough because that's what enabled us to prevail in this crisis. The loser makes exactly the opposite calculation. We lost because we weren't tough enough. Right? Next time, we have to be tougher. And you see a certain evidence of that, of those kinds of calculations being made in the period before World War I. And then there's a sense of crisis after crisis. Any of these things could have led to a European war. You know, who knows how long the peace could be maintained? War is probably inevitable. Right? People, especially in the militaries, then began to think in preventive war terms. If war is inevitable, maybe we should have it out with them while we are still relatively strong. And the way this kind of reflects itself in the political sphere is the rise of what you might call touchstone arguments. Not necessarily that they wanted a war, but they adopted hardline policies in the belief that, war would be inevitable if the other side is as intransigent as it might seem. We can see how intransigent the other side is by taking a tough line now when we're relatively strong. Because if they won't accommodate us when we're relatively strong, well, there'll be no living with them when we become relatively weak. So let's have the test of strength now. Not necessarily war, but let's have it out with them diplomatically now. Right? So you can see how all this stuff kind of contributes to the problem. You know, fuel on the fire. Okay, what does all this mean about the issues that we're concerned with? These theoretical issues. Yeah. Obviously, there's a lot more to the war than just one side deciding to start it. Like one side is like, you know, decides to kind of plunge all of Europe into the war just for the hell of it. You know, the war is the climax of this story. And when you look at the different policies that are pursued, you could have, you know, a certain sympathy for why these different states did what they did. Right? Aggressor theory, it doesn't really hold up that much when you look at the origins of the war. What about the second theory that blames the structure? It's the system that's responsible. The old diplomacy, you know, of power politics, you know, this amoral old diplomacy, the alliance system, the arms race. I have something I want to show you. About the whole notion of the arms race. Again, this is one of these very common oops, what happened here? Oh, forget it. The alliance system. Was that a cause of the war? People think, oh, well, you know, each country was able to drag in its partners because once you have an alliance, you have to, you know, do what your partner wants. Not true. The problem was that you couldn't totally trust your allies. Instead of hard, rigid alliances that worked automatically, people were worried. In Britain and France, they were worried about maybe Russia defecting over to the side of Germany. That's why they had to give Russia pretty much of a blank check. That's an important argument. The alliance system, it wasn't its rigidity that was the problem, it was its weakness. The arms race. I have these figures I wanted to show you on the course website. It's under maps and tables on the website. And look at the very bottom. Click into the link there for military spending. It's very low in the period before 1914. You know, it's like, and not rising as a share of national income. In the case of Germany, it was something like 1.3% of national income. That compares to something like 5 or 6% for the United States during the latter part of the Cold War, double that for the Soviet Union, greater still for a country like Israel, spent 30% of its national income on defense. Right? This whole notion, the arms race caused the war, doesn't hold up. What about this whole business of the old diplomacy and power politics being the problem and how we should think in moral terms and so on? When you examine this whole story, you're struck by exactly the opposite. It was the failure to think in power political terms that lay at the heart of the problem. I mean, just take the case of Germany, for example. Here's Germany. She has, important defensive interests in Europe. Plus, she has these imperial aspirations. What does Germany do? She pursues a policy that alienates the three next most important powers in Europe all at the same time. She alienates Russia by siding with Austria over the Balkans. She alienates France over Alsace-Lorraine. She alienates the British over her naval building program and her imperial aspirations. Right? Does that make sense? You know, biting off more than you can chew. If you have a security concern in Europe, that should be your number one concern. You can't afford to siphon off resources, the construction of a big navy that simply drives Britain over to the side of your adversaries. It doesn't make sense, right? Britain and France, this hostile policy that they pursued vis-a-vis Germany, above all in the two Moroccan crises, basically alienating Germany, empowering Russia in the process, creating a situation where they're virtually forced to underwrite these aggressive Russian goals. Does that make sense? Wouldn't it make sense to kind of accommodate the Germans to a certain degree, hold out some hope for the Germans, if only to avoid becoming prisoner of Russia? If you think in power political terms, if you're a Bismarck, and those kinds of considerations just come to you immediately, you would never have pursued the policy that those countries pursued. Right? Structure by itself is not the answer. Why is it not the answer? In large part because it's ahistorical. It doesn't give you sense for what's specific about a process that has a certain momentum to it that develops over time. It's like, well, here's the structure. It's a Europe of five great powers. There's no supernatural or national authority, or no overarching authority to limit what they could do, right? That's the structure. Well, that structure was in place all along. Doesn't explain why war came in 1914. To get at that issue, you have to reconstruct the process that led to the outbreak of war. And when you do, and you understand the logic that underlies that process, then you could get some sense for what actually caused the conflict. Totally different way of thinking, very important. But also, all these things are important to bear in mind because of the importance of this issue in the post-World War I period. How the issue should be analyzed versus how it, in fact, was analyzed. That will give you some insight into the story that we're going to be examining in the next part of the class, the story of the failure of the peace that was imposed on Germany after 1918. But next time, I want to kind of focus in on the July crisis in 1914 and again view some of the theories that have been developed to explain why war came during that very important month.